Thank you for joining us today in this conversation on The Sword and the Trowel. Today, Pastor Tom and I talk with Brandon Weikert, who's a friend and a member here at our church, at Grace Baptist Church. And he's also a foreign policy and technology expert who's done a lot of work in Washington, D.C., and academic work as well. It's a fascinating, interesting, very helpful conversation that we've had with him on different issues regarding politics. I hope it's helpful to you. Take a listen. Welcome to The Sword and the Trowel. The Sword and the Trowel is a podcast of Founders Ministries, and Founders exists for the recovery of the gospel and the reformation of local churches. I'm Graham Gundin.
And I'm Tom Askell.
And today's episode is brought to you by Squirrely Joe's Coffee and the Miller's Grove Soap Company. Today we have a wonderful friend with us and a fellow church member, Brandon Weikert. And today we want to talk with Brandon about some foreign policy and the way that Christians ought to think about foreign policy and different things happening in our government. Brandon is an expert in these things. I forget all the different things that you do and all the things you've done. I know you've written for Popular Mechanics. I know you've written several academic books on these things. You've been a contractor with the Department of Defense. But maybe, Brandon, if you could just tell us all the things that you do, and that would be helpful.
And then we'll just close off the episode and say thank you for listening.
Hopefully I'm not a jack of all trades, master of none. I started out working in politics when I was 16, volunteering, and then ended up just kind of falling into that. I didn't go to college right away even. I was working on campaigns. Ended up going to DePaul University in Chicago and kept going with politics all during that time. I was the president of College Republicans, part of the Conservative Union. And then ended up in Washington, D.C., working on the Hill. And worked for Ted Yoho, congressman out of 3rd District of Florida, Gainesville area. And Ted's philosophy, as he told me the first day, was to just say no to everything. So that made my job really easy. Yeah. Nope, there we go. So move on. And then from there, I ended up doing consulting work on and off for the government and doing my master's at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., which is a pretty specialized school for national security. It was founded by a bunch of Cold Warriors. So John Linchowski and Dave Thomas and all those guys were there from DIA. Spent some time at Oxford. I was going to do my DPhil there, but I have Crohn's disease and I got very ill and lived through the British health system and said no more.
Wow.
And so did not finish there. And then I fell into writing and getting published. And I was a senior contributor at American Greatness, which was a sort of the pro-Trump answer to National Review during the 2016 campaign. I worked with Chris Buskirk and some of those other notable names, moved over to an editorial position at the American Spectator in Washington, D.C., and then, wrote several books.
Now tell us about – what's the first book you wrote?
Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower.
All right. And this is only like 3 or 4 years old, isn't it?
I've been writing it. That one took me the longest to write. I've been writing that since 2017.
Okay.
But when I worked on the Hill, I fell into space policy and they called me the space cadet. They used to make fun of me. And so, yeah, that one came out in September of 2020, right during COVID.
Yeah. So you basically – argue against all those guys that laughed at Trump when he started Space Force, right?
Well, so I say this with all humility, but that book was part of the kind of effort that was
get that going.
Yeah, yeah. So I was on the periphery of that. I was supposed to have been brought in to the National Security Council in the first term during the transition. Unfortunately, I was. I don't even know the guy, but I was part of the Christie failed transition.
Yeah.
And then Bannon and Kushner came in and nuked all the names.
Okay.
So I got, that was unfortunately not a possibility. So I went off and said, well, this still needs to happen and I still have contacts and I'm going to try to become a public advocate.
Yeah.
And so very much that was sort of my first kind of foray into policy advocacy outside of Congress.
Like
I was a private citizen at that point.
And you wrote this book on China as well.
That was my third book. Biohack. That was a result, obviously it covers a lot of COVID. But I had a lot of contacts as a, I consult with the DOD, although I think DOGE may have killed that recently. So I don't think I'll be consulting anymore, which is fine. But I used to consult for about a decade with DOD, and I have a lot of contacts in the intel community. When COVID hit, I had a lot of people queuing me up on background saying, hey, this is not above board what happened. This is not a normal disease. And so I tried desperately to get what I was being told published. I reached out to Tarrant, to the editor over at Wall Street Journal, Molly Hemingway. I was even right-wing publications would not touch what I was saying because they're worried about getting sued. But I was one of the original. It was me and a couple other people like Gordon Chang who had a lot of leads in China who were saying this was a bioweapon. In fact, I had a Marine, and I talk about this in that book, I had a Marine Corps colonel who was Marine Intelligence who in late January, early February of 2020, I was at an event in D.C. doing my talks, a lot of which cover space and biotech. I cover a lot of what's known as fourth industrial revolution technologies. So like the new the new technology, biotech, quantum computing. That's a lot of what I talk about. And after my talk, the colonel came, two of them came up to me from Marine Corps Intelligence and kept using the term biological 9/11. And they knew something more than what we were being told. And so after not being able to get my articles published, I said, you know what? I'm going to sit down. And I'm going to write a book. And that was the result. And that book is more than just COVID. It's about the whole process of biohacking. CRISPR-Cas9 was a technology we developed, Jan Dudna and them, to do gene editing. In fact, when I met my wife, she was at Yale doing her PhD in genetics, and this was what she was doing. And so she was a huge fountain of information for me writing that book. In fact, you know, my wife worked for Dr. Collins at NIH and before I met her. And so I learned a lot just talking to my wife about this stuff. And so from there, wrote the book. And so it's more than just COVID. That's sort of the hook. It's about what is China doing with the help of Western pharmaceutical companies, NIH, NIAID, the Winnipeg lab. What's going on with biohacking in general using CRISPR-Cas9 to create what the Chinese call, their general calls them this, specific ethnic genetic attacks. COVID, I argue in the book, was just a test run for them to try something even more lethal. In fact, that lab in Wuhan is playing with smallpox. So
don't tell me things like
that. This is why they call me a doomer sometimes. You know, I try not to be, but you know, this is these are the things I deal with.
So you, these are two of you've written four though, right?
And
the other two books are.
I realize I didn't bring A Disaster of Our Own Making. I meant to. I apologize. The newest book. I have a book called The Shadow War: Iran's Quest for Supremacy, which came out in 2023. I turned in the manuscript in 2022, and it predicted the October 7th attacks. And so obviously lately I've been getting a lot of press for that. And then my other book that just came out is called The Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine. And it's been described derisively, although I take it as a compliment, as a revisionist history of the war in Ukraine.
Interesting.
And so, which it is in some respects, it's, you know, things are not what they seem in that conflict, and it, you know, it's something we should not be involved in.
So, Brandon, I mean, obviously, you're a Christian church member here with us. It's been great getting to know you over these last year or so, and interested in how you came to Christ. I loved hearing your testimony. So, tell us about how you grew up here in Southwest Florida and came to know the Lord Jesus.
Yeah, well, when I grew up here, I went to Catholic school and was long line of Catholics, Roman Catholics. And I believed in, you know, God, and I believed in what the Catholic Church taught, but I started noticing certain things as I got older in the church that really kind of disturbed me, notably the liberalization of the Catholic Church, going the same way as the Anglican Church has gone, and that worries me. I never could quite articulate it. And I think in my youth, I wasn't as passionate because of the fact I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know what. And I continued with the Catholic faith, so much so I went to the largest private Catholic university at the time, I think it still is, in the country, which is DePaul in Chicago. And there, I don't even think you can call it a Catholic university at all. Mm. In fact, the former Pope, Ratzinger, wrote a cease and desist letter to Father Holtzschneider, the president of, at the time, DePaul University when I was there, saying if you're going to continue celebrating what's known as Gay May, which was basically the administration allowed LGBTQ plus whatever groups and abortion activists onto the church grounds to advocate for their preferred lifestyles, the Pope at the time told them you cannot advertise yourself as the largest Catholic private university in America because this is in defiance of the word.
It's not very Catholic.
Not very Catholic. And what was amazing was Holtzschneider apparently went to the Vatican and somehow walked out still standing and basically argued that because we were a Vincentian sect of Catholicism, that somehow that gave us special privileges.
Interesting.
We were our own order. And at that point, and I was very active with campus politics. I was a student rep to the political science. We were one of the few universities where students could actually be elected to sit in on tenure decisions and actually have a say in tenure decisions. Mm. So you can imagine all my professors who knew me were very frightened by the prospect of having a raging right winger, you know, deciding their tenure. And I did kind of stymie a couple of people, which did not make me very popular. Although some of the other professors were very happy with me because they didn't like these people either. But at that point, though, I questioned a lot of things because the Catholics were not, in my opinion, serious. Mm-hmm. And I sort of was in the wilderness for probably 5 or 6 years thereafter. Met my wife in D.C., and we ended up getting married very quickly. And once I got married and we had our first child, at that point I started to want to get more, you know, get back into faith. But I couldn't go to the Catholics, and so we kind of meandered around D.C. My wife was raised Anglican, so at first we went there, you know, to the, and it was not, I mean, that was even worse than the Catholic Church. We ended up going to a Baptist church in Alexandria, which of course is now a controversial church, but that is where I was baptized. I felt very, something I had not felt many years, was a very strong connection to the principles of the Baptist faith, and you know, and I tried to really orient myself, and I felt something true. That I didn't feel during my time as a Catholic.
And so, but you weren't taught Baptist principles or anything like that.
Once I got in, my wife and I both started reading.
Reading the Bible, being under the preaching of the word.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we felt convicted and we felt called.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from there, it was, you know, we stayed in that church. And of course, the longer we stayed in that church, First Baptist of Alexandria, as you know, is a problematic church.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I realized that it was funny because I knew something had changed in me because I could sense that as we were there longer, there's something off here.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately, because of COVID, we ended up fleeing Northern Virginia and coming to where I was raised down here. And, you know, we were looking for a while for a church, and we went to McGregor first, and then we ended up here. But I, at this church, I feel more attenuated to God than I have felt in any other place.
And we're all better off for it here.
That's right. That's right.
You guys are here. We love having you here.
Thank you.
Cleanse your hands, ye sinners. That's what the Bible tells us, and you can do so now with Miller's Grove soap. Miller's Grove is taking dominion over God's good earth by putting grass-fed beef tallow, milk, honey, and essential oils, along with other gifts from creation, into their luxurious soap and bath products. Miller's Grove is done right here in Cape Coral. It's by one of our elders and his wife and family. They unashamedly fear the Lord and seek to build his kingdom as they are building this business. They never use junk. junk like harmful seed oils or synthetic detergents or fragrance oils containing phthalates or parabens. Listeners of the Sword and Trowel have an opportunity to get a special discount by using Founders at the checkout for a 10% off of your first purchase. So remember, life is short, fear God, build His kingdom, and use the good soap, which is Miller's Grove soap.
Quid est hoc? What is it? Few questions are more basic or more important than defining what a thing is. In philosophy, defining the nature of something is called ontology. And in this book, ontology goes by the title isness. Questions like, what is a human being? What is a man and a woman? What is marriage? What is a family? Stand at the heart of modern ethics. And Christians who love their neighbors need to have good answers to these questions. As creator, God defines what the world is and how it is meant to work. And in this word, God has revealed what those definitions are so that anyone who takes God's word seriously can know what God has said about himself, his world, and everything in it. In his forthcoming book, The Business of Isness, How to Live in the World God Made, David Schrock aims to help faithful Christians see from Scripture what the world is as God intended. You can pre-order a copy today at press.founders.org.
One of the things that was fascinating to me when I first got to know you is you came to Christ in this church. You know, the Bible's read, the Bible's preached.
That's
there.
Right.
Christ was
That's
preached.
Right.
You trusted Christ. As you began to grow, you realized, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That the folks that led me this way are not leading me in the way that we ought to continue to go. And they're opening up and going left.
Yeah, and that's it. They were, well, what I realized, and I knew, so at the time I was working in government, and the pastor there, he was a nice guy with me. I know he has a bad rap. I never had any problems with him. But I noticed, though, he was really fixated on political connections.
Mm.
A lot of our members were very powerful people at DOJ or some of these other, and he was really fixated on like the politics of the area. And at first I was like, well, that's just normal for this area. It's a company. DC's a company town, right? It's government. That's what they do. But then I was like, that's a little weird. And the more we got into the church, there, some other things came up, and then my wife started noticing things in her small group. And, you know, I'd like to think, though, me being saved is what allowed me to say, this is not normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, maybe we should start questioning and even necessarily distancing ourselves. Because we started distancing ourselves probably about 4 or 5 months before we actually decided to move down here. And I spoke to some people. There's a lot of people who left the church. Didn't say why, but there's a group. One of them was a gentleman who was tapped to be an undersecretary of the Air Force for Trump, and his nomination was held up. And I was at an event in D.C. giving a lecture to the DOD, and he was in the audience. And he said, hey, afterward, he goes, I know you. And I was like, yeah, you look familiar. And he said, do you know what's going on at the church? He didn't want to talk about talk about the church. And I was like, well, I've noticed some things. He goes, you know, my wife and I aren't there anymore. And he said, and this is why. And so, and now, of course, I know from, I think a year ago, you were at the convention.
Right.
And there was, you know.
Yeah. All kinds.
We started noticing it then. But yeah, I do think it was, you know, it's funny. Yeah, I was saved there. And yet, very quickly, I noticed that they were veering away.
Well, that's the Spirit of God and the Word of God, and praise God for that.
Yeah.
So, all right, you're gifted, you're experienced, and this is your world, your wheelhouse. And it's just fun talking to you, listen about and hear about the things that you are up to speed on, understand, and have predicted and seen. Most Christians just aren't there, though. I mean, I'm certainly not there. I would not know one-tenth of the things that you know or that I've even heard you say if you hadn't said them. So why should Christians be concerned about these international kind of galactical scale concerns that are going on in the world?
Yeah, well, the first thing I say is it affects us, you know, especially if you have kids. I mean, just look at the biohacking, right? I mean, COVID affected. I mean, it really ruined our kids' lives for a period of time. I heard somebody on the radio the other day compare it to that generation's Vietnam. And when you think about it, I mean, at first you go, well, that's not. But then you go, well, no, it really eviscerated people's lives.
Especially the younger they were.
Especially the younger they were, And, you know, most people did not do well during that time. And so, and that was very much, you know, I am convinced that what the inputs I was given by people in the know, and that prompted me to write that book, BioAct, that what we endured was a bioweapons attack.
Yeah.
And in the book, I make the argument, the possibility. Now, I can't definitively prove this, but the context of why China chose that time to leak that weapon was because they had just endured the protests in Hong Kong. Then Trump initiated the agricultural trade war. Now, in Chinese history, if you ever study Chinese history, what are the two biggest takedowns of any dynasty? It's rebellion in the outlying regions plus famine. And so Xi Jinping, looking out the window of, you know, his palace, is saying Trump is not trying to get a better deal. He's trying to take me down. Mm. And so I'm going to take him down. I'm going to unleash a disease that, yeah, it's lethal, but it's not the end of the world, but it's going to cause the Americans to go crazy.
Yeah.
And it did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a regime change. I guarantee you, regardless of whether 2020 was manipulated, that election or not, and it probably was, but regardless, had Trump never had to deal with COVID, there is no way that he would have lost. It would have been just like 24, where the margins were so great, he wouldn't have been able to be defeated. But because of COVID, and the lockdowns and everything, and people are afraid. That's what that was about. COVID was about taking out the Trump administration because of the agricultural trade war. And a lot of people disagree with me, and you know, the Wall Street editorial board says that that's not right. Well, no, it is, because even the Chinese economic advisors for Xi admitted that the Chinese price of food skyrocketed during the agricultural trade war with America. Because they were highly dependent specifically on soybeans from us, and we were cutting them off. And so while you can make some economic arguments that, well, it hurt Americans too, it did. But ultimately, that trade war triggered what was probably a bioweapons attack on us. Well, that affects everybody. You know, a Middle East war, like my book, The Shadow War, talks about with Iran. That's going to affect everybody, especially because the prospect of loose nukes. You know, we're talking about World War III possibly erupting, and that's almost biblical, right? I mean, is that's the region where, you know, this ancient region, you know, resonating with all of this, you know, history of religion and overlaid with nukes. I mean, this is, you know, that's where a world war could potentially erupt, more likely, I think, than anywhere else.
Well, maybe let's talk about that a little bit. You know, I think obviously there's a lot that's been going on in the Middle East for a long time. But especially recently over the past couple of years, I mean, you've had the October 7th attacks on Israel and the response there in Gaza. You've had the fall of the Assad regime there in Syria. Yep. And it seems as though even more recently, things are gearing up to an even greater, hotter conflict between Iran and, well, really, I mean, it seems like a lot of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So maybe if you can walk us through and maybe some, like a 30,000 foot view level of what's happening right there in the Middle East and what should Christians be concerned about?
Well, the concern should always be, you know, is this going to expand into something greater where now our food supplies and our electrical grid and, you know, the basic stuff of life here is suddenly now a target in cyber war or electromagnetic weapons and things like that. And so that's the concern for us, for ordinary people, especially Christians. I mean, that's, you know, where we live here too. And so it's going to affect our community. Luckily, I feel like our community, though, is strong and we probably would come together, you know, in ways that others probably wouldn't. But still, it's a very daunting prospect. In terms of the 30,000 foot view, basically, the Iranians have been peeved, particularly the Islamists who rule Iran, have been peeved that their brand of Islam in the Muslim world is not the dominant. They're Shiites. Most of the Muslim world are Sunni.
Which has really always been the case, right?
Yeah, yeah. But of course, if you go back to the 7th century and to the secession crisis between Muhammad or Muhammad's grandchildren after he died, the issue was, do we have a bloodline heir lead the caliphate, or do we have basically these jurists decide who is the most capable? The Sunnis said the jurists should decide, and the Shiites said no, it should be the blessed bloodline. And that is where a lot of the division in the Muslim world occurs. That is playing out today with the Islamist regime of Iran, where they want to dominate the Muslim world with their form of Islam. And in particular, the Iranian form of Shiism is called Twelver. It's a very specific millenarian view, has to do with this belief that I think it was the 10th century, I think it was the Abbasid dynasty basically occluded. They had to hide their imam, their grand Mahdi, from the Sunni Arabs. And the belief is that, I think it's the 11th imam or the 12th imam, I'm getting my astrology here confused, but basically the Iranians believe they must trigger the apocalypse in order to free their Mahdi, the 12th imam is what it was, their Mahdi from occlusion, from hiding, who's been hiding out for centuries upon centuries. And so it's this, and the Mahdi is their Messiah. And that is a very specific Shiite belief. And that's what they want to impose on the Sunni world. They want to correct their apostasy. So there's a whole religious kind of tone. And that is why, beginning in 2015, Mohammed bin Salman, who was the crown prince now of Saudi Arabia, MBS is what he's known as, shorthand. He was the defense secretary or the defense minister for Saudi Arabia, and he initiated a massive war in Yemen against Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. And part of this is because he knows the Iranians are nuts and they want to do all these things. And if they can get nukes, that is the fear, both in the Sunni Arab world, at least in Saudi Arabia, the leadership. There's divisions even within that, though, and within Israel. So that's sort of where Israel and Saudi Arabia, the leadership is aligned, is they don't want Iran with nukes, because there's a wing of Iranian leaders who are Twelver Shiites who believe in this literalist interpretation of the Mahdi end times scenario. And then you have, on the other end, you have the issue of Israel. Now, Israel is this, you know, it's a country, I think, the size of Rhode Island. It's predominantly Jewish. It is a democracy. It's an advanced country. It is a partner of the United States. It is a conduit for U.S. power projection in the region. The Iranians do not like us. They do not like the Israelis because of their relationship with us, but also because the Israelis are Jewish. There's a common, in my opinion, misconception among people that, you know, Iran is angry because of the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. That is not accurate. The Iranians, the Palestinians are Arabs. They're Sunni, right? Hamas is a Sunni Arab terrorist group. Iran supports them, but as a means to an end. Okay. The Iranians do not give a whit about Palestinian statehood. In fact, no Islamist cares about Palestinian statehood fundamentally, because most Islamists do not believe in the nation state system. They think that is in itself a product of the Christian world, and they want nothing to do with it.
Fascinating.
So people who are saying this right now need to understand that Hamas in particular is using Iran, and Iran is using Hamas to weaken Israel. That's all they care about. And then Hezbollah to the north in Lebanon, that is a Shiite terrorist group. They are directly linked to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, which is the elite ideological troops of the Iranian regime. They want to crush Israel on religious grounds. They also want to crush Israel, again, because it's a conduit in their minds for U.S. power projection, and they don't want us near them. They want to create the kind of a bubble where they can then dominate the Middle East and go from there. It's not in our interest to let them do that. I don't think we should be going to war over this, but this is the reason why we have been consistently opposed. the Israelis definitely don't want the Iranians to build a bomb. Yeah. They definitely don't, you know, because the Iranians will use it is the fear. The Iranians, you know, the Iranians, a part of that regime wants to use the bomb.
Are you a Christian struggling to find companies that align with your values and beliefs? Squirrely Joe's has you covered for all of your coffee needs. All of their coffee is hand-selected and roasted fresh every day by a family of fellow believers. Try them out and you'll savor exceptional coffee while knowing that your investment supports a company committed to following God's teachings and upholding truth and righteousness, ensuring your hard-earned money contributes to the growth of God's kingdom. Stop giving your hard-earned dollars to pagans who support evil. We have a fantastic offer for our listeners. The first bag of coffee is free. All you have to do is cover the shipping. Head over to squirrellyjoes.com/founders to claim your free bag of coffee today.
I'm excited that we are publishing here at Founders Press a new book for children, The Pilgrim's Progress, A Poetic Journey by Paul and Stephanie Cox. You may recognize Paul from his RefTunes work that he's done, and we've partnered with him to provide this very colorful, beautiful rendition of The Pilgrim's Progress for children. Encourage you to get a copy of it and introduce every little child that you know to this classic by John Bunyan. The Pilgrim's Progress is the greatest book that has ever been produced in the English language, and God has used it throughout history since its publication to bring many people to a deeper understanding of the Christian faith and to introduce them to the Lord Jesus so that they too might journey to the celestial city. So if you go to press.founders.org, you can order your copy today.
So, and Israel, the thing with Israel, though, they have like 200 or 400 nuclear weapons. Very sophisticated.
Nobody knows
right,
that.
Right. Very sophisticated weapons. So what I tell my Jewish friends is that, you know, the Holocaust was terrible, but we're not 5 minutes away from the Holocaust. So let's just everybody take a breath, because 200 or 400 nuclear weapons, Israel has a nuclear dyad where they have land-based nuclear weapons, the bulk of their force. Actually, I think they have a triad as well. Yeah, they have triads, because then they have the F-35I, which can deliver nuclear warheads. They also have a handful of Dolphin-class diesel submarines that are floating off the coast of Iran probably right now, and they have nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. So the Israelis are fine. You know, they have some breathing room. They don't perceive it that way, but they do. But they do not want Iran to get a nuclear weapons capacity, and or rather to build from what they have.
Because they're just crazy enough to use it.
That's the fear.
Yeah. And how close do you think Iran is to having
I think
that?
Iran already has
You it. Think they have
I think that's why yeah. Trump is – so Trump, he's heavily influenced by the neoconservative wing right now on Israel. And so this is why you have 37% of the B-2 bomber fleet – in Diego Garcia right now. We have 19 B-2 stealth bombers. Six or seven of them are there. This is a rarity. It's a very expensive thing to move these systems from their base in Missouri to stationing them semi-permanently in Diego Garcia. So that's usually an indicator, that many with all the attendant resources. Trump was very serious about blowing up suspected Iranian nuclear weapon sites. In the last week, he has veered away from that. I've been told that he visited Walter Reed last week. This is something he tends to do before making an action with troops. And I think he's having second thoughts because he's worried about the second and third order effects. The thing with the Iranian regime, they are a terrorist dynamo. They probably could not stop airstrikes on their nuclear sites, particularly ours, using stealth. We would also be using electronic warfare planes, the Growler, that would really complicate the Iranian ability to defend their sites from us. But the Iranians could absolutely retaliate, and they have a very sizable retaliatory capability. And I think that's what's worrying Trump. We've got about 60,000, maybe more now, U.S. troops within firing range of Iranian long-range missiles. And the Israelis are now also within range of their missiles. The Iranians, probably thanks to the Russians, have the Fatah-1, which is a hypersonic missile that can hit Israel, as far away as Israel. There are no active defenses against a hypersonic weapon. This is why our Defense Department is wigging out right now about Russian and Chinese hypersonics. We have no active defense against these systems. Iran now has it. It's probably the Russians who gave it to them. And so while we could probably get those nuclear sites, there will be second and third order effects. And I think Trump is wondering if maybe we can get a deal. It looks like Witkoff, his envoy, is trying to do that. And if that's the case, the question then becomes, what are the Israelis going to do? Because if the Israelis think they're going to get annihilated, they might not let Trump have that window of opportunity at diplomacy. And so that's sort of the big concern right now with what's going on in Iran. Personally, I would assess the Iranians have a maybe 20% chance of being able to stop our airstrikes. But what every leader needs to ask, and this is what George W. Bush didn't ask, what every leader needs to ask is what comes next? What will happen? I can assure you, I've met troops who were injured with brain injuries after the Soleimani strike. You know, we took out the leader of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in the first Trump term. The Iranians fired ballistic missiles at our bases in Iraq. The U.S. servicemen were grievously wounded by that, a lot of them. This was covered up. And so I've met a couple people who have brain injuries from this. And that keeps Trump up at night. So does he want to? Because what's going to happen is we can hit those sites. They're going to retaliate. It'll, you know, the regime itself is very brittle. I suspect there would be a revolution of some kind in Iran. But then that gets us into a whole nother thing. Are we going to now, what, get troops on the ground? What's Turkey going to do? You know, in D.C., the Shah's grandson is a huge lobbyist in D.C., and it is looking like he's angling for us to give him the blessing to try to initiate a regime change. Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, has since August been talking about the prospect of using the Shah's grandson to overthrow the Islamists in Tehran. That has Ahmed Chalabi vibes that really kind of worry me, because this is exactly what the neoconservatives were telling us about Iraq. Hey, we've got a guy, Ahmed Chalabi. He's connected. We're going to send him in. He'll be our government in a box. And as it turned out, nobody knew who he was. Now, obviously, the Shah's grandson is much more popular than Chalabi ever was in Iraq. The Shah's grandson is much more popular in Iran. But the question is, there are other groups on the ground in Iran. If that regime falls apart, are they going to want the Shah back? Are they going to want the monarch back? Or are they going to want something else? We shouldn't even be getting into this because it's not our problem. You know, and I think that's Trump's mentality. We don't want Iran to get nukes. They already probably have nukes. The question is how sophisticated. I suspect that they probably have some rudimentary nukes that they're playing with. The fear among nuclear weapons experts is surge capacity. Can they build systems quickly? I've been hearing from people on the ground that they've already got, I think, 30% highly enriched uranium. Another person was, I mean, you know, so the point is they've already got nukes. They don't have sophisticated nukes yet. Can they get those? And can do they have sufficient delivery systems to actually make that a real threat? In the shadow war, my book offered a third way, because I don't think you could, I personally don't think you can do a deal with these people. I think Trump thinks he can. Maybe, you know, he's touched. He's Trump, so he might. And I would tell my Israeli friends to give him a shot. Let's see. But I personally don't think you can do business with the Iranian regime. I also don't think we can afford a war right now. So maybe we should look at finalizing those Abraham Accords that Trump started in his first term, which was designed to bring the Israelis and particularly the Saudis together in a closer security cooperation framework so that they could pull their resources and kind of do to Iran what we did to the Soviet Union in the Cold War, contain and deter them until they eventually collapse under their own weight of their own internal contradictions, which is what happened with the Soviet Union. That's a very unpopular opinion right now in D.C. Nobody wants to talk to me about it. They want to either talk about going to war or peace. So that's sort of my take on it.
So how does, you know, the the Assad regime in Syria fell recently over the past few months. How does that then play into all of this?
Well, so it's very important to understand Assad was not a nice guy. You know, he wasn't somebody you wanted to hang out with, but he was protecting our Christian brothers and sisters, and he was protecting pretty much all the minorities in the country other than the Sunni Arabs. They're not a minority. They're a majority, actually, of the country. Mm-hmm. The Sunni Arabs, most of that population, notably in Hama, which is the big city where the Sunnis are, they are infested by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the mothership organization for all Islamist ideology. It was started in 1928 in Egypt by a guy named Hassan al-Banna, who wanted to overthrow the British Empire in Egypt. And that kind of filtrated through to a thinker named Sayyid Qutb, who was sort of the Lenin of Islamism. He actually lived in Colorado for a period of time in the 60s. He died in an Egyptian prison. They sicked the dog on him and he had a heart attack. But his ideas lived on. You can still read his books. Milestones is the book that I had to read. That is one of the most influential Islamist texts. It inspired bin Laden, for instance. That's one of the key books that inspired him. But the Syrian government under Assad was at war with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're at war with al-Qaeda. They're at war with all these groups. We knocked them out. I say we. I should be specific. It was really the Turks, with the help of the U.S. intelligence community, notably CIA, I suspect. But also Mossad was tacitly in approval of this. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand, Israel and Turkey don't like each other, though. But they were happy to see this happen because the Assad family for decades has been a thorn in Israel's side. And so
is this because their connection with Iran?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So Syria. So what happened was after 2003, we toppled Saddam. And in order to do that, we had to make deal. The U.S. had to make deals with the Iranians, and the Iranians exploited the vacuum by creating a land bridge through the Shiite populations in southern Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon. And it allowed them to basically connect their power. Mm. And so we had Iran contained until 2003, and then we let them out of their box. And yeah, so Israel was very upset because obviously Hezbollah is an even bigger threat to Israel than Hamas will ever be. Even though Hamas did the October 7th attacks, Hezbollah is a well-armed paramilitary organization. They've got the precision-guided missiles to completely eviscerate. For instance, they planned on using these precision-guided munitions Hezbollah did to knock out the ammonium nitrate facilities at the port of Haifa, which would create a miniature nuclear blast. Knock out the port of Haifa, you've knocked out 20-30% of Israel's economy. It ain't coming back anytime soon. That means it's going to hurt their war effort. Those precision-guided munitions from Hezbollah can knock out electrical grid. They can reach as far down south as to the part of Israel near the Gaza Strip. So that's all because of this land bridge that Iran was able to build through Iraq, Syria, into. So yes, that's Assad was a big thorn in the side of Israel. So they did not cry when the Turks said, hey, we're going to get rid of this guy. Mm. And what you find studying, and I've studied them, I've been involved with Middle East politics for a long time. You find is these groups hate each other, but they all use each other.
Yeah.
You know? And so getting rid of Assad gave a window for Israel in that ensuing chaos to extend their defensive perimeter up to Mount Hermon, I think, Hermon, which is about 25 kilometers to the west of Damascus. And they were able to extend their defensive perimeter there and build an air corridor linking Israeli airspace over Syria, northern Iraq, into Iran. And that was how in October, for the first time, Israeli F-35Is were able to do a comprehensive airstrike on the air defense perimeter around the Fordo Iranian nuclear facility. They knocked out, I think, six Russian-built S-300 air defense systems. There's some back and my friend Will Shriver, who's a great geopolitical analyst, says, Brandon, the Israelis are lying. They got their butts kicked by the Russian built air defenses. It was all prop, whatever. The point is, though, they now have an air corridor linking, which means they have escalation dominance against Iran. They never had that clean airspace to do these long range strikes like they have now. The thing is, you know, we don't know how Syria is going to go now. Israel cannot anticipate being able to hold on to that much territory in Syria indefinitely.
Yeah.
So this is also why Netanyahu's like, we got to go now. Plus Netanyahu's up against the wall politically, and this gives him a lot of, you know.
So what do you think is going to happen in Syria? I mean, if you just had to kind of sketch it out from your perspective.
I am very critical of the new government, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. That is a lovely Turkish intelligence repackaging, CIA repackaging too, of ISIS. Mm. So the guy who heads it, Jalani, who now wears a, like Arafat used to, wears a lovely suit and looks very, you know.
Moderate.
Mm-hmm. He was a head chopper. And his defense minister, there's actual video, I've seen it, of him going on mass beheading sprees just 10 years ago of minorities in Syria during the civil war. Some of his people were the ones behind that very infamous video of the 8-year-old boys being beheaded in the back of the pickup truck. Those were HTS fighters. Back then we called them ISIS, but now they're called HTS. And I do not think it's going to go well for Syria. You know, I think our Christian friends are going to get a knife. I said this to William Wolf a few months ago on his podcast. I think our Christian brothers and sisters are going to get annihilated. You know, the Israelis are protecting the Druze, which is a subgroup in Syria. And some of the Christians have moved into that territory, knowing the Israelis are protecting it. Some of the Christians are trying to get over to the Deir ez-Zor side of Syria, which is the eastern side that the U.S. has been holding since 2012. That's where all the oil is.
That's a coincidence.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, there's absolutely nothing related here. And that's the Kurdish side. Waleed Faris, who's a friend of mine, I know him, you know, he's talking about this land bridge connecting the Druze and the Kurdish side, and the Israeli and the American sides are going to link together in this very, very long and impossible to defend land bridge. It's not going to happen. There's going to be no humanity. That's it. And this is why Israel is now realizing they got conned by the Turks, because this is what the Turks do, right? I mean, my great-grandfather was British intelligence, and I remember as a kid he would say, never turn your back on a Turk. And, you know, the Turks do not want to see Israel survive, particularly the current government. It's an Islamist government. They have pretensions of being the new caliphate like they were.
New Ottoman Empire.
Neo-Ottomanism is the ideology that Erdogan professes to support. That's his ideology, is neo-Ottoman, with himself as the sultan. And so he very much wants to become the dominant Sunni power in the region. And part of that plan is to use Syria as a conduit for Turkish power projection. And eventually, I keep telling people this, and they look at me like I have three heads. The biggest threat to Israel is no longer Iran. Iran has been put on its back foot. They're stymied. You know, they're all in a defensive crouch now, and they're not getting out of it anytime soon. The real threat to them, for the next decade, in particularly because of Syria, is going to be Turkey. And what do you do about Turkey? They're an advanced country. They're a NATO member. It shows you gets us to my other book, A Disaster. It shows you the stupidity of NATO today. By the way, Turkey's picking a fight big time right now with Greece in the Aegean Sea. I have a report at the National Interest coming out later this week, hopefully, about how Turkey's purchasing 38 of these short-range missile systems from Israel, and they're placing them on these Aegean Sea islands so that they can better threaten Istanbul and Izmir with destruction because the Turks are coming hard at the Greeks. This is ancient, right?
Yeah, we've seen this before.
We've seen this before, right? So this is like, and so what's going to happen to Syria? My prediction, I've said this since 2013 was the first time I said this. Yeah. Back in 2013, I said this. Syria, in our lifetime, will cease to exist as a effective nation state. Mm. It's going to be, you know, divided and bifurcated, and I guess not bifurcated, it'll be cantonized if we're lucky. But there's not going to be a Syria as we understand it. It's going to go along its ethnic religious lines with high degree of exploitation from Turkey, partly Israel, and whatever remains of the U.S. presence.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
I want to invite you to join us for the National Founders Conference, January 22nd through 24th, 2026, here in Southwest Florida. Bodie Balcom, Joel Beakey, along with Dusty Devers and Alex Kochman and David Schrock, will be joining me as we address the theme, Make Disciples, God's Mandate from the Home to the Ends of the Earth. We want to explore what God requires of His people as creatures made in His image, as well as disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ. For more information and to register, you can go to founders.org/conference.
I want to let you know about a new title that Founders Ministries has just put out, and that is The Abstract of Systematic Theology by James Boyce. It's actually not a new title at all. It's a very old work that was written centuries ago by the very founder of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It is a systematic theology in brief, and so it covers all the different issues from doctrine of God proper, soteriology, ecclesiology. And not only was it formative in the starting of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and even in the SBC in the early years, but actually the Lord used this work to reinvigorate the doctrines of grace in the Southern Baptist Convention in the 70s and 80s. Ernie Riesinger used to travel around the different Southern Baptist conventions handing this book out to graduates of the seminaries. And from that work and from that ministry, out of that ministry, even Founders Ministries began. So this is a wonderful new edition of The Abstract of Systematic Theology. You can go to press.founders.org and grab a copy for yourself there.
My grandfather came from Damascus.
I know.
I've often wondered if I would be able to go.
Well,
probably not.
Well, you know, that's one of those we'll see.
Yeah.
Because I don't think the current government, HTS, has the juice to actually hold on to power.
Hmm.
And we know this from Islamist. Normally, the path of Islamist groups, they fight their way to power. And then they end up turning on everybody, including each other. I mean, this is why. So HTS formed out of the detritus of Al-Nusra Front, which was an Al-Qaeda franchise, and ISIS, and some of these other smaller Islamist groups that started saying, we don't like the mother group, so we're gonna kind of reorganize into our own faction. And so what happens is these Islamists turn on each other as much as – it's sort of like that that scene in Monty Python – which, you know, is not a good movie to watch as a Christian. But before I was not recommending it, but before I was really saved, I did see it. But there is a funny scene when they're all arguing over the different like names of the Judean Liberation Front. Well, no, we're that's sort of like what the Islamists end up doing with each other is they turn on each other.
Yeah.
So HTS, TBD on whether or not they actually stay in power or if they start killing each other.
Okay. Mm. Well, if you ever hear of an entryway into Damascus
I'll
or somebody
you know.
Can go and preach the gospel,
you
I would love to go.
Go now, but I wouldn't recommend
right,
it. You know,
right.
If you want to keep your head on your shoulders, you know, that seems to be their forte over there right now.
Well, it seems one of the lessons in all of this. I mean, you know, Christians are not foreign policy experts, and it's hard to know.
Some Christians are.
Well,
some Christians are. It's hard to know what's actually happening, what kind of news you can trust, all that kind of stuff. But one of the lessons that seems to be pretty clear for me is, you know, we just – good things don't happen when we meddle in other people's regimes.
No.
Right, when we try to change regimes and things like that, as we've tried to do so many times, or as we have successfully done so many times.
Right.
It doesn't go very well.
Right.
And it just, there's a domino effect of, well, this is what's going to happen. And then this happens. And then this happens. And then many of the problems that we're looking at right now that we're dealing with are problems of our own making.
That's right. It's literally.
And we haven't even talked about Ukraine yet.
Disasters of our own making. That's like the American foreign policy establishment's motto. Basically, and it's funny because Jean Kirkpatrick wrote about this in her last book. And I'm blanking on the name. It was published after she died in 07. It was posthumous. But she in the first chapter, she goes through, and of course, Jean Kirkpatrick was the Reagan ambassador to the UN, and she was a staunch interventionist during the Reagan years. But interestingly, people don't remember this, she actually sided with Pat Buchanan in the early 90s in terms of against Charles Krauthammer. So there was a move after the Cold War ended. We're looking around going, what do we do now? Right? It's the end of history, right? What do we do? And Pat Buchanan and Jean Kirkpatrick got together at the National Interest, where I'm a senior national security editor, and they wrote a series of essays. And Jean Kirkpatrick's is probably the best rebuttal to Charles Krauthammer, who was a neoconservative, used to be on Brett Baer's show on Fox News all the time. Yeah. He was a gentleman, but he was an interventionist extraordinaire. And he said, Krauthammer did, it's the unipolar moment. Exploit it. Meddle everywhere because no one's going to stop us. And this was, of course, what we ended up doing. Kirkpatrick wrote an essay called A Normal Country in a Normal Time. And it was all about how the Cold War is over now, so we need to start focusing on making America great again. And all this other stuff is not relevant to the importance of making sure our constitutional order at home is in fact in order, which it was not. She was saying it was not. After 40, 50 years of Cold War, there had been a lot of distortions in our society, and we needed to focus on, this is what Pat Buchanan was saying, this is what Ross Perot was saying. Jean Kirkpatrick wrote in her last book, she has a whole history of the UN, which I thought was really interesting because she hated the UN. She was the UN ambassador. She hated the UN. And I don't like the UN either. In fact, I was at CPAC on the main stage 2 years ago, and I said, disband it. so I'm not a fan of UN. But she did talk about the original idea that Eisenhower actually articulated when he was president. The original idea was no interference in the internal affairs of any country. Because once you start doing that, you have those knock-on effects that nobody else is prepared for. You don't even think about it. And then suddenly you find yourself, oh, golly, we're in the middle, you know. And she was using that at the time in 07. She was writing about, and she talked about how George H.W. Bush, as he was leaving office, intervened in Somalia on the most humanitarian grounds. But that handed off to his less effective successor, Bill Clinton, who'd had no patience for foreign policy, really, ended up creating the disaster in Mogadishu, which was the Black Hawk Down incident, in which, this is not well known, it was Al-Qaeda on the ground that actually shot down those helicopters. They trained based on tactics they learned from us fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. So that's a whole other story. But she was saying, Kirkpatrick was saying that actual founding principle of the UN actually is a good principle. It's just that nobody follows it.
Yeah. It's not the mode of operation of the UN anymore. In fact, it's the opposite.
It's the opposite. Oh, and any of our, I mean, I saw it up close. My first week on the job on the Hill was a big deal. It was the week we were choosing to arm Syrian rebels or not. Now, you know, my boss, just say no. So, we were one of the only no votes on the House Foreign Affairs Committee saying we are not doing this. I had Kirk Clausen, who was the former rep down here. I think he was after Trey Radel and before Byron Donalds. Kirk Clausen came up to me in the hallway. I'll never forget this. He came up to me because he knew that I was technically registered. I never left. When I went to college, I kept all my registration and everything down here. So I was technically his constituent, and he was friends with my boss. And he said, hey, he goes, my foreign policy guy is telling me I should vote for this. You think, why are you telling Ted? I said, we should not be involved at all, Kurt. And he goes, well, that's not what I'm here. And I was like, okay, well, you do your thing. But, you know, that was, you know, that we have meddled and we continue to meddle, and you see the consequences.
So I mean, this is probably the last question that we have time for, but in terms of where our own governing regime is right now and our meddling in foreign affairs, it seems as though there's a more prominent voice in places of power that are against that kind of thing. Where do you see our own government going? I mean, I think we know where Trump is to some extent in terms of interventionism and all that, but what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to. I still have a lot of contacts with Russians And I was talking to a Russian friend a few weeks ago, and he asked a very similar question, because there, the Russians are completely perplexed by us. Mm. They don't. Of course,
I am too.
Right. Of course, remember Brezhnev apparently was completely confounded when we got rid of Nixon because of some, as he said, petty crime. Right. we confound the rest of the world. So he asked something similar, and I said, "Well, you have to understand." I said, "You're talking about a government that currently the head of the government, Donald Trump, actually doesn't represent the government."
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
This is very – so when, if you're trying to get a deal, this is very confusing to people.
Yeah.
Because our government is so insulated and so powerful and so well protected from reality. You know, I lived up there. Washington, D.C. Who was it? Somebody said – I had a doctor up there who said D.C. is 10 square miles of fantasy land surrounded by a horrific reality. You know, and so it's true. So nobody up there has any clue about – the real world. And they have a chief executive who they are at war with actively. Mm. And in the first term, they were able to effectively stop him. In the second term, he had Elon Musk for a while, who I think was probably the best aspect of the new administration. And now that he's gone, I hope that Trump has somebody watching his back, because I don't know. You have the world's wealthiest guy watching your back, and now he's not as involved. That could be a problem for Trump. So your question is, rather, the answer to your question is, if Trump can't get it right every day for the next 4 years, which, that's a tall order, just going off his first term, he didn't get it right every day then. But if he can't get it right now for the next 4 years, it won't matter. What'll happen is the system will return to autopilot. Mm. Yeah. It's a lot like the Byzantines at the end of their time, right? It was so bloated, and they had so much bureaucracy. The emperor could say whatever he wanted, but they have all these, Byzantine bureaucracy, right? And so my fear is that if Trump doesn't clean out the government a substantial degree, if he can't avoid some of these wars, at least for the first couple years, if he doesn't pass legislation, so this is another big thing, and I don't mean to meander here, but this is all connected. Trump has done a wonderful job with these executive orders. He's not gotten really any major legislation through. So what's going to happen is, if he doesn't get legislation through, that means the MAGA movement is not going to be codified into the law, right? The New Deal was codified into the law. The left is codified. Their stuff gets codified into law and outlasts them for decades. If Trump doesn't get legislation, which I don't think he's going to get much legislation through, if Trump doesn't get legislation through significantly starting now, the next guy, whether it's J.D. Vance or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, can go through and just undo every single thing. Mm-hmm. Overnight. In fact, if you remember Biden's first day in 2021 after inauguration, he sat there at the desk with his apparatchiks holding him up like Weekend at Bernie's. And he was signing those executive orders. He was signing were undoing all of the executive orders from Trump.
Yeah.
So he did that in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So that's what DC's hoping for. And that tells you, that tells me that the constitutional government as we know it is broken. And, it's probably not coming back. Mm. And so, and that scares me as a Christian, because, you know, what does that mean for us? Well, it means that our survival as a religion in this country, as an institution, is going to depend upon the whims of Caesar. Mm. And so that scares me. And I really hope that Trump can keep at it every day for the next 4 years, because if he can, we can at least slow down the rot. Mm-hmm. Maybe not reverse it. Maybe the next, if he's successful enough, then he gets his successor in, or maybe he stays in for another term. I don't know. but then we can not just stop the rot, we can reverse it. Mm-hmm. So that's, I don't know if that's an answer that's very effective. Well,
it's food for thought, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And this has been an incredibly interesting, fascinating, helpful conversation.
Thank you.
We're going to have you on again.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
We're going to have to talk about more. We didn't even touch Ukraine and Russia. We only said NATO once. So
right. I think the title, though, of my book pretty much sums up disaster for our own making. It's pretty much my stance.
Yeah. And the submarines book, is that coming out anytime soon?
I'm probably not doing it now. I'm looking at... I've got a couple of different things I'm looking at. I'm trying to figure out what's going to make the most amount of money too, because you know, you got to pick a subject. Everybody, sure. These are pretty esoteric subjects. The one of two I'm looking at is either one on the Arctic that I've been working on for years. Mm. And it's proceeding at a glacial pace. That's my dad humor. And then the other one I'm looking at that I might be doing is on the rise of the tripolar world order. Which is America, China, and Russia. No longer a unipolar world order run by America. It's now three unstable, unevenly matched powers. And we had to figure out how we're going to – because most tripolar systems – Richard Rosskranz shows this. Randall Schweller shows this in his book on World War II or the interwar years. Tripolar systems almost always devolve into world wars or major wars because you have three uneven players jockeying against each other. So how do we survive that?
Well, I'm fascinated to read that when it's done. So
thank you.
That'd be very interesting.
It'll be nice when I have it done. I'm just, you know, this is the problem with writing books is I have all these ideas and I have to sit down and write it. So.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
On.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
And thank you so much, audience, for being here for this conversation. I hope it's been helpful to you. If it has been, please do like and subscribe and share on all the different platforms that you listen to these podcasts. And we will see you next time.